The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 12, 2021. This panel of the court today has four cases on its agenda. The second case is case number A20-1559, In Re the Matter of the Welfare of the Children of S.D. I believe counsel are both familiar with our protocols. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent the appellants MK and RK in this case today. Now, Your Honors, we are here this morning on an appeal from a motion for an adoptive placement that's under the juvenile statutes, Minnesota Statute 260C.607, Subdivision 6. What this statute really talks about is that a relative of a child who is in placement may make a motion, and if the motion and supporting documents make a prima facie showing that the agency has been unreasonable in failing to make an adoptive placement, then the court, if the court makes that prima facie finding, may set the matter for an evidentiary hearing. Now, having handled a number of these, as well as from my prior experience handling family law, where these are analogous to motions to modify custody, the prima facie showing is really, quite frankly, I think what's very important and what I was going to focus on today, especially when you break down and look at that prima facie, really what that means is at first sight. So at first sight, the court reviews the documents to see if a prima facie showing has been made. And that's really interplayed throughout what is also the standard of review. And so under the standard of review, it's a little bit more complex in that under these motions, it's actually a three-part analysis.
Ms. Dawson, I'm going to interrupt you already and jump right into the first part of that three-part standard of review. One of the arguments that you make in your brief is that the district court did not treat the motion papers, your client's motion and affidavit and other submissions properly as required. Specifically, you allege that the district court relied on information outside of the record that you provided in support of the motion. And I'm wondering if you could identify for us exactly what that evidence was that the district court relied on outside of the record provided by your clients.
Well, and Your Honor, I think the way to essentially frame that argument is, as you highlighted, that's the first standard of review where this court is now conducting a de novo review. And under that analysis, quite frankly, the argument is not whether a full analysis of whether the agency was unreasonable. It is really a prima facie analysis. And so, Your Honor, to me, the most important case in this respect is the case of the LLP case, where the court of, in this case, it was rather interesting. When you look at the findings of fact, the court seems to be going down that road where it is treating the arguments as true. So, for example, the findings of fact, the court specifically found that there were threats of harm from LTD toward LDK. The court specifically found that the appellants were really actually trying to protect the children. The court also specifically found that the appellants believed that all of this could happen and that LTD could actually be returned to their care. So then what's interesting though is where the court then shifts is in the findings of fact, those are the findings that the court makes. But then when you get into the conclusions of law, there seems to be in the conclusions of law kind of some mixed fact and legal analysis there, but within the conclusions of law, specifically under where I was really looking was paragraphs 13, 14, and 16, where it really appears that the court is analyzing within this entire case, the history of this case, which is really actually what the department asked the court to do, rather than using this prima facie at first sight look. So at first sight, the other issue here within that first analysis also comes an error in that the court misinterpreted its Minnesota statute 260C.221 subdivision B2, and it's at the later part of the court's order. I apologize, I did not write down the specific paragraphs.
If we could just go back for a moment to the paragraphs of the order that you just identified, the paragraphs that you're alleging are problematic. Specifically, what parts of those paragraphs are you concerned about?
Your Honor, I'm concerned that in paragraphs, so when the court's reviewing, if I can kind of back up here just a tiny bit to answer that question. So when the court is reviewing, as I said, the court is supposed to take this first sight. Anything that is to the contrary is supposed to be disregarded. It can allow context, but really nothing more. Again, it's supposed to take it at first sight under the notion that really the moving party, it's not their job to prove their entire case. They simply have to lay out enough facts. So my concern with paragraph—
Ms. Dawson, I think the problem that we're struggling with is that the district court order is very replete with saying it accepts the supporting documents as true. And as Human Services has pointed out, you haven't raised any factual allegations that the district court didn't consider as true. And that's what I'd like to know. What did the district court not consider as true?
Well, Your Honor, I think where I was going with that is really that then what happens is while the district court in one sense says they're taking it as true, they then place it in the entire context. And the other issue is when you're looking at paragraphs 13 and 14, the concerns that the district courts noted, that's really not context. That's the court conducting essentially a reasonable analysis rather than actually simply taking the arguments as true.
So and the if issue- I could, if I could stop you there. So looking at paragraphs 13 and 14, would you agree that all of the facts included in those paragraphs were facts that the district court accepted as true, taken from the materials that were submitted in support of the motion?
I apologize, excuse me. Your Honor, the fact that is true that within, and I'll just start with paragraph 13, is that my clients do note in their affidavit that they did allow, I believe it was LTD, to speak to her mother briefly on the phone. However, then the concern comes in that the court is then making this value judgment, this reasonableness judgment, that's demonstrating limited insight. It's almost as if the court is now engaging in some sort of a determination. It's placing that then within the context and is going to now this extra step of limited judgment, when really the fact of it was that the clients were saying, we did this, we were not given direction from the agency as to what was allowed. And so we thought that this was okay. And even if you look at it and compared to the foster parents, they also allowed it to happen. And so it's again, now the argument is that the district court has taken it from simply that prima facie into a full reasonableness analysis.
In other words, you're arguing that the district court was weighing the evidence.
Yes.
And my next question for you is, you know, I see what you're saying about certainly the last statement in paragraph 14, where the district court does appear to be conducting some weighing, but does that matter? In other words, can we set that aside and look at the other information that the district court included in the case and conclude on the ultimate question of unreasonableness that the department did not act unreasonably?
And that actually brings me into what was the secondary component to my argument under simply just actually only the first prong of the standard of review, which is that in the later paragraphs, and now that I do have it in front of me, I believe it's 1920, where the court is analyzing 260C.221B2, which really that statute talks about if a placement early on in a case may choose to not be a placement, if they come forward later, that cannot be used against them. The court, quite frankly, misapplied the law, and we did analyze that in our responsive brief, where the court cites, it actually makes a factual error in its own findings, and that the court says that the clients did this after all rights were terminated. Well, as we highlighted, in fact, when this decision was made, when this request was made to have LTD removed, and again, the court makes the finding temporarily, that was done for her safety, and that was done in December of 2018, long before parental rights were terminated. And so not only does the court make an error there, but then it does seem to read the entire rest of its analysis of that request for removal through the lens that this statute does not apply to the appellants. And
is it your argument that given the statute, the district court was not permitted at all to consider the request to remove child one?
Your Honor, I think that that's where we get into, does the court have to look at it? I'm not going to sit here and say the court has to completely ignore that. But I also think the court then has to interpret that through the statute of what were their reasons, and the court has to accept as true that their reasons were that they felt LTD needed additional care, that they thought she would get that additional care, that they thought that she could be returned to them, and that in fact they came forward again and said that they would like her back. So I'm not saying that the court has to ignore it, but just simply it has to be taken within their facts alleged.
Well, let's talk about their facts alleged. Another question I have is, you know, what is the proper scope? Because certainly your client submitted an affidavit, but your client also submitted other materials to the district court in support of the motion that contained some information that was inconsistent with the information in the affidavit. And is it appropriate for a court to consider all of that? Is a court allowed to weigh and choose among the evidence that was submitted in support of a prima facie case? It sounds like the district court maybe did that, and it's not clear to me what a court is to make of conflicting evidence submitted in support of a motion.
I guess what specifically did Your Honor feel was inconsistent? Because I think the court seemed to, I think, question whether my clients really actually thought this was a temporary removal. Is that the question? Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, what it seems to me is the court was getting that from your own materials that were submitted, you know, the letters that were included.
Well, and I think, I think that the court seemed to question that they had never told the department. However, I think when you also take that with, they were also very clear that when the department came back to them, and in fact, even asked them if they would still like to be placement, they said yes. And so to me, I guess that would get into, then there's a question of how to handle that. And quite frankly, I believe then at that point it gets into, that would definitely be potentially an issue for trial, an issue that would have to be addressed. And again, keep in mind, and this is one of the arguments that I made down at the district court, this is a prima facie finding that then goes to potentially a trial. And at a trial, there's only so much information and so much that can always come out through affidavits. It's really at the trial where the court gets the benefit of the testimony. And again, it's not saying that my clients ultimately get placement. It's simply just saying they get a trial. And so I think the court The court seemed to raise that question. However, again, the court also has to accept as true that they did say they thought this could be temporary. They did say that they wanted her back. And when you look at that, that's what the court is accepting as true, or should accept as true.
You say wanted her back, you're not talking about the older child? Maybe
Your Honor, I am talking about LTD. I am talking about the older child that they did believe.
My concern is this: in these type of proceedings, we always consider the paramount best interest of the child. That's just fundamental. We do that. And I don't know that I specifically remember the dates, but I know both children, in particular LTD child one, has been in this foster care placement since, I think, 2018. And the second child since 2019. I mean, should we not consider that the children are together in the best interest of the children and in remaining in the present situation?
First of all, Your Honor, I just want to clarify, both children were not placed in their current placement until September of 2019. That when child one was removed, she was actually placed in essentially a shelter care. And if I could just really briefly finish the answer. Then, Your Honor, when you get into that best interest analysis, quite frankly, when you look at 260C.607, that best interest analysis, when you look at the specific subdivisions of the statute, really actually that type of analysis does not occur until you get to that trial. This first stage is only the prima facie. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsels. My name is Kayla Rodriguez. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I'm here representing Ramsey County Social Services Department. The agency is asking this court today to affirm the district court's order denying appellants an evidentiary hearing under Minnesota Statute 260C.607. As Ms. Dawson has laid out, the appellants did file this motion more than 22 months after they demanded that LTD be removed from their home and over 13 months after LDK, their biological grandchild, was removed from their home. Taking the appellant's submissions as true, as we've acknowledged that the court must do and did do in this case, the court was proper in finding that the appellants did not meet that prima facie showing. In this case, the appellant's direct actions were what led to the placement ultimately not being determined for them for both children. The appellants were the
So Ms. Rodriguez, if we look at the paragraphs that were identified by Ms. Dawson, 13, 14, 16, especially, I mean, the statement that the grandparents demonstrated limited judgment, or the grandparents showed poor judgment, that they did not put the child's emotional well-being and needs first. I mean, those statements are not found in the motion or in the movement's affidavit, correct?
They are not outwardly found, no. The appellants did not say that they demonstrated limited judgment. However, I think in the appellant's submissions that they did acknowledge that there was an issue with their behavior and the actions that they took during those visits.
How did the district judge come to those? How did the district judge make those statements? I mean, what did the district judge rely on in order to make those statements?
I think that in this case, the district court relied on the entirety of the submissions of the appellants in making those statements. This court understands that the best interest of the children is the paramount consideration overall. And I think in reading the totality of the circumstances in this case, taking all of the submissions and taking what I would describe as contradictory statements within the own submissions, the court was outlining how those contradictory statements resulted in the court finding that there was not a prima facie showing. And I think that the district court could not simply ignore that there were contradictory statements and did include that language to identify how it had reached its ultimate conclusion with the appellants not making a prima facie showing.
And do you agree that those statements in 13, 14, 16, those do go directly to the issue of whether the county acted reasonably in not making a placement?
I don't think that they go directly to the ultimate question of whether or not the agency was reasonable. I think that those statements go to whether or not the appellant's submissions were able to establish that prima facie showing, and that the district court was outlining that with those statements. I don't think that the district court went to the specific finding of saying, you know, absolutely the agency was reasonable in finding an alternative placement, but did identify that within the appellant's submissions that that was the conclusion that it had to reach. And to go to the other point that the your honors have suggested, I think that appellants are suggesting that the district court should have ignored their choices and ultimately the bad facts that are against them in favor of the good facts that they presented. And I don't think that the district court was able to do that, nor should have done that when we're considering a prima facie finding. Understanding that is a low bar, of course, you know, but it still is a threshold. And ultimately the district court had that discretion to decide based on every single thing that was submitted, whether or not the appellants had made that showing. And I think here, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, you anticipated my question by my mute button action there. So I do have a question, Ms. Rodriguez. One fact that stands out to me that was included in the grandparents' motion papers and was not really addressed by the district court, I don't think, was that the county reached out to the grandparents in May of 2019 to inquire whether they'd be interested in having LTD come back and being considered as a permanency option. So that's a fact that's out there. And I'm just wondering how you would recommend this court deal with that fact in addressing any of the questions, you know, whether the district court properly treated the motion papers, whether the district court erred in finding a prima facie case or not a prima facie case.
I think as to that fact, that the district court did take into consideration the rest of the appellant submissions, which although I agree that there is a sentence in the submissions that they were willing to take LTD back into their home, there are essentially pages of their concerns and why they did not feel that LTD would be safe with their grandchild LDK. And there's really no reconciling that against the other allegations that they make about LDK. They don't indicate in any of their submissions, you know, why they were willing to then receive that child, what had changed. And I think essentially the end result is that in their filings, they were willing to receive LTD after learning that LDK would be removed because a placement had been found. And so I think that the district court and this court should take that fact in the context of the entire submissions of the appellant's filings. And I think that that's how that can be reconciled. In this particular case, the appellants are essentially asking the district court and now this court to set aside their decisions in favor of ultimately their desire to have the children placed with them. And I don't think that that's really what the prima facie showing standard is designed to do. If we were to consider every relative that said, I'm a relative and I want placement to therefore have established the prima facie showing, that would lead to an absurd result. And when we're considering the best interest of the children, which I believe is an inherent consideration, even in 260C.607, I think across the board, that is something the court must consider, that in so doing, it would significantly delay permanency for children. And particularly in this case, has delayed permanency. These children have been out of home since February of 2018. So we are over 1,000 days at this point. And the overarching consideration is the best interest of the children.
And I think that the court—
Can I just stop you there? Where in the analysis that's set forth in the statute for determining whether an evidentiary hearing is appropriate, and in the case law, the LLP case, are you finding the best interests inquiry? It doesn't jump out at me as something that's explicit, and I think you acknowledge that it's implicit. But I mean, isn't the only question whether the department acted unreasonably? And is the best interest— are you arguing that it's somehow grafted onto that inquiry?
The plain language of 260C607 does identify that the question before the court is whether a prima facie case has been made. But within the same statute, which is 260C, I believe it's 0.001, that outlines that all considerations, you know, the paramount consideration is the health, safety, and welfare and best interests of the children. And that is liberally construed within 260C to be applied. And so I think that while the primary consideration is, yes, whether or not a prima facie showing has been made, the best interest is, I think, as you stated, it is grafted in there, and that must be a consideration, not to outweigh, obviously, an appellant's submissions, but that it is something that the court can consider properly within the submissions.
And just to pick up on that analysis, once the court's decided to grant an evidentiary hearing, explicitly told by the statute to then consider the best interests of the children in making the ultimate determination?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think, again, as I stated, really every step, the best interests of the children plays in. But I think what Your Honor is saying is from 260C607, that subdivision does lay that out, yes. I think in this case, appellants don't reach, you know, that step of the motion request, because again, their submissions do not reach the threshold that they're required to reach. And I think that the district court did properly consider their submissions within the context of the case. They I think admittedly include a lot of the history of the case even before some of the children in this matter were even born. And they include a lot of history that the court considered. And even if they hadn't included the entire history of the child's removal and kind of what had led up to our motion here today, is that it would not make sense for the court to have to ignore the history that's in its own record, and not to outweigh that, and not to immediately say, well, you had the child once, you don't get a child again. But it would reach an absurd result to simply say that the court could not consider its own history in context. And I think that that's what the court did here, based simply on the appellant's submissions, but it certainly could have reached that same context within the court's own record.
One thing that I find a little confusing is, you know, the case law says that we're not to, or that the district court in conducting the reasonableness analysis is not to consider the procedural history of the case as it goes to whether a prima facie case has been made, but only for context. Thinking about the facts of this case, the request for removal of LTD, is it your argument that that's not part of the procedural history, or that it is part of the procedural history? And how are we to evaluate that if it is part of the procedural history?
Your Honor, I would argue that it is part of the procedural history, but in this case, the appellants included it in their submission. So it's already able to be relied on by the court because that was included in their submission. If it was not included, I think that the court could still consider it as context when we're looking to a question about adoptive placement. The children's placements, previous or current, is certainly a consideration that the district court needs to make in determining whether or not the placement was unreasonable. The court having the knowledge from the court record about previous placements certainly wouldn't inform or at least contextualize how the agency, the court, and the prospective adoptive placement or the requesting adoptive placement had kind of reached this moment in time. And I think without that context, as I stated, essentially it would be that any relative could have an evidentiary hearing. And I do not believe that that was the intent nor the spirit of this, the legislature.
It seems like if we were to affirm, we might be creating in effect some per se rules about what, you know, if a prospective adoptive parent does A or B or C or all of those things, they are disqualified effectively from an adoption. I mean, and I guess, you know, those things in this case might be giving, saying that, you know, that at one point in time that they are not interested in one of the children, or showing limited judgment about letting the child speak to the biological mother on the telephone, and so on. I mean, I think that by applying a de novo standard of review at that first step, we're essentially saying, as a matter of law, is this a viable adoption petition? And if those are the reasons for saying no, then it effectively creates a broad rule, does it not, that a parent who does any one of those things is, as a matter of law, not qualified to be an adoptive parent.
Your Honor, I see that my time has ran out. Could I briefly respond?
Yeah, of course.
I don't believe that in so finding that it would automatically set a hardline rule about what is or is not acceptable under a 260C607 motion. I think even with the de novo review, these type of motions are very, very fact specific. And what has occurred in this case is very unlikely to ever occur in another case in the exact set of facts that we're looking at. And so that does still allow for discretion from the district court and ultimately this court, if it were to reach this level on a different case. So I don't believe that it would establish a hardline rule, as every case, certainly when we're dealing with these type of scenarios, have different facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rodriguez. Ms. Dawson, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple notes. One, I want to note there was an argument that, in essence, it seems that the actions of my clients may be delaying an adoption. I would like to note for the record that that was not brought up down at the district court level, and I believe to attempt to raise that argument here would not be proper, especially given that the district court case is still proceeding, and I believe there is additional information there that is not before this court. Second of all, there was a question about reconciling the interest in having LTD come back. And I think it was very clear from my client's affidavit that following removal, not only was LTD in shelter care, but she was not receiving any therapy. And here is a child who there can be no question has suffered more traumas than any child should have to suffer, and was engaging in behavior that the district court found could be harmful, and yet she's removed and is receiving no therapy. And so part of what my clients very clearly wrote in their affidavits was they had already had her in therapy. They at least knew they could meet those needs. And so they were willing, since it was clear to them that the agency could not meet those needs, that at least they could do it and they could take her based on that. Lastly, Your Honor, as to the argument that in essence, my clients, this would create some sort of a broad rule that any relative that files a motion would get an evidentiary hearing, and that could be absurd. Your Honor, I think that that's way too oversimplifying, especially when you look at these parties. These parties are not just relatives, they're grandparents. They were the only stable placement, the first stable placement for LTD, quite frankly, in her life. They were the only home that LDK had ever known her entire life until she was removed. They had LTD in therapy for the first time in her life to address her needs when she moved in with them. She could not even read the word I in a sentence. And so they got her up to speed in her education. They focused on attachment with both of these girls. They focused on their safety. They focused on keeping these girls connected with their relatives, with their past, with their history. Your Honor, these are not just a relative who popped up one day and suddenly said, I would like to have this child. These are relatives who were, quite frankly, extremely involved and have that attachment. So those were the only points that I was going to touch on, unless there are additional questions.
It appears not. Thank you, Ms. Dawson, and thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within the time limits required by law.